Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Crime stories in this hour. Later on, we hear the tale, Experiment 6R, on suspense. But right now, it's a broadcast of The Whistler from May 22, 1949, on the CBS Pacific Network. It's Joel Malone's story, Fatal Fraud.
And now, stay tuned for the mystery program that is unique among all mystery programs. Because even when you know who's guilty, you always receive a startling surprise at the final curtain. In The Whistler.
I am The Whistler, and I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
Yes, friends, it's time for The Whistler, rated by independent research the most popular West Coast program in radio history. Now the Whistler's strange story, Fatal Fraud.
The questioning by the Hong Kong police was brief. The suspect's guilt was clear, coldly clear as the murder weapon itself. And it was inevitable that it should end with an official booking for murder. But even though a conviction was a certainty, the motive and circumstances behind the crime were considerably more complex. It had started more than a week ago at a fashionable gathering across the city. A swank social affair with smartly dressed ladies in evening gowns and jewels, gentlemen in dinner jackets. And the precise moment might have been when most of the guests adjourned to the library and listened to that well-known voice and stared at the man who spoke.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until the New World, with all its power and might, steps forward to the rescue and liberation of the old.
Oh, wonderful, Chris. A perfect impersonation.
That's our Winnie, all right. You could fool me.
Well, that's what he's famous for.
Thank you, thank you. Not quite famous.
Well, you should be, young man. All those voices, why, it's fantastic.
No, it's practice, that's all. And the living.
Is it a good living, Mr. Holmes?
Huh? Oh.
Oh, Catherine, you haven't met our clever young man. Chris Holmes, Catherine Dorn.
How do you do, Miss Dorn?
Fine, thank you. And you do very well, Mr. Holmes.
Oh? You like the impersonation?
Very much. That routine of yours must be quite tiring. Don't you think you've earned yourself a cocktail?
He certainly has. Now run along, you two.
Join me, Miss Dorn?
You know, Mr. Holmes, that's exactly why I came over. I hate to drink alone.
Alone? You? Oh, don't
I'm not really an invited guest, just part of the help, you know. A secretary.
Hmm?
I'm here with my employer, Albert von Loven.
Oh, the importer.
Hmm. Know him?
The very nice old Dutchman. The rosy cheeks, bald head, eyes that sparkle. He holds his head to one side like this when he talks.
Oh, not impressed, Miss Dorn? Don't you think I do it rather well?
You were excellent, Mr. Holmes. Excellent. Come along, before the martinis get too wet. Chris, you know you dance as well as you impersonate.
Sure, I've been copying Fred Astaire.
I mean it.
You mean a lot of things, Catherine. Or, is it the cocktail?
How many have you had?
Well, I did become a bit impatient waiting while you were talking to Van Loven.
You shouldn't have. I was acting in your behalf.
Oh?
Mm-hmm. You are invited out to his home for a few days.
What?
Whose idea?
Mine. I thought it might lead to something for you.
Lead to something?
Mm-hmm. I think your talents are wasted on nightclubs.
Thanks, but the importing business isn't something one picks up overnight. No, Catherine, I'm afraid
that... relax, relax. You're not going to turn Mr. Van Loven down. He wouldn't like that. Neither would I.
You know, you're odd, Catherine.
So are you. And two odds make an even match. Don't they, Chris?
Catherine is an interesting girl, isn't she, Chris? And you're pleased with her interest in you. Pleased and a little flattered, because she's easily the most attractive girl at the party. And the following weekend at Van Loven's, you're even more impressed. Her friendliness puts you perfectly at ease, and you feel almost a part of this way of living. It's a very pleasant way, isn't it, Chris? Dinners on the terrace, brandy in the drawing room, excellent company, and later in the evening in Van Loven's private office, Catherine again. She's standing by a recording machine this time.
What's this going to be, baby? Hong Kong's version of Hong Kong's blues?
You'll see, Chris.
VSL calling, Canton office. Attention, Carter. Regarding back orders on shipments of Oriental rugs. Cancel and hold in warehouse until further instructions. Please notify us immediately regarding jade and artwork. Regards, Van Loven.
Hey, what's this all about?
Don't you want to learn the importing business? Make big money, opportunities for young, ambitious men.
Is this the special mail order course?
And I'm the teacher.
Hi, teacher.
Hi, Chris.
Come here. You like it?
Better than an apple.
Yeah. Catherine, why'd you ask me here? I'm just a guy kicking around.
I know. Maybe better than you think.
Not so sure you do. I'll admit I've been in a few deals that seem shady.
Sure. That's what I said. Two odds make an even match.
You still haven't told me why you asked me here.
Chris, I want you to help me do something. It's simple. He's bringing in some money in a few days. Lots of money. A kind we can keep up with.
Look, what are you talking about?
Van Loven, Chris. And his Canton office. The details don't matter. All that I'm interested in is the money.
And me?
And you. You know I'm interested in you, Chris.
Draw the pictures, honey. The bright boy's a little dazed right now.
We're going to get that money. Oh, Chris, it'll be so easy.
Yeah?
Simon will help us.
Who's he?
He operates the radio shack here.
Oh, that's a nice hobby.
Oh, Chris, you're not even listening to me. Don't you want money?
Sure.
Well, there's plenty, Chris, and it's all coming in by plane, Van Loven's plane. It will land only where he directs.
Simon?
Mr. Van Loven, he's going to direct his pilot over the radio. Listen, you could change those directions, Chris. You're good.
Oh, now, wait a minute.
Chris, there's a quarter of $1 million. More.
Quarter of a million?
A third of it can be yours.
Yeah. But, Catherine, hijacking a plane, that isn't easy.
It will be. Seaman and I can handle the pilot once the ship's on the ground. He won't suspect anything until it's too late. We'll tie him up, get out of Hong Kong before Van Loven hears what's happened.
Destination?
Oh, darling. There's an awful lot of elbow room in Asia. Chris, come on, tell me you'll do it. Take this record and practice Mr. Van Loven's voice.
That's a breeze, that part.
Canton office. Regarding back orders, Oriental rugs. Cancel.
What was the rest of it?
Notify us. Jade and artwork and stuff regards Van Loven.
Oh, Chris, you know you're marvelous.
Yeah. Say, Cap, you really think we can get away with it?
We can. And we will, Chris. We will. You'll do it?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
The money, Chris. It's real, not an imitation. You'll see.
Sure. You're not either, Catherine. You're right here and real. That much I am sure of. Come here. We're getting out of practice.
And now back to the Whistler.
You've made a decision, haven't you, Chris? Yes, you've decided you're going to help Catherine with her plan to hijack her employer's plane arriving in Hong Kong from Canton with almost $250,000 aboard. And your part in it is all so simple. You've only to impersonate Albert Van Loven's voice. Order the pilot to land at another field where Catherine wants it to land. It's the opportunity of a lifetime, isn't it, Chris? And the future grows brighter and brighter as you think about it the following day. Then that evening, Catherine takes you across the back gardens to a low, rambling building, a good distance away from the house. You find yourself entering the radio room, where you meet Rene Simonot.
Rene? Rene, this is Chris Holmes.
So this is the famous one, eh? The one with the voices.
Hiya, Simonot.
He's going to help us, Rene.
Is he?
You don't seem enthused, old boy.
I am not.
He's afraid our little scheme won't work, Chris.
There are other ways. Better ways of doing this, Kathleen. If you'd only listen to
me. Rene, must we go through all that again? With Chris to help us, we cannot fail.
I don't like it, that's all. There are better ways.
Maybe it's the money that bothers him, Catherine. Getting only a third of the loot instead of half.
A third? Catherine, did you tell him
yes?
that he...
I think he's entitled to a third.
I see.
Don't look so glum. Third share will buy you a lot of scented hair oil, Simonot.
Chris.
By the way, what's that you have on now? Eau de Violet?
Chris.
Listen, smart boy. I know it's good for you.
Stop it, Rene. Stop it. You're acting like a child. Let him go. That's better. We've more important things to do than quarrel. What time do you expect the plane to arrive here in Hong Kong?
At 11 tomorrow night.
Good. We'll be ready, won't we, Chris?
As our friend Van Loven would say.
We will be ready, Katrina, my dear.
You see, Rene, he is good, isn't he?
Excuse me, Katrin. I have things to do.
Excuse me, Katrin. I have things to do.
Oh, darling. You sound just like Rene.
Yeah. Well, at least we get along, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Well, come on, darling.
Kath.
Mm-hmm.
Can you trust him?
Simonot? Yes. Yes, I can trust him.
What makes you so sure?
Oh, I've known him a long time.
He's in love with you, isn't he? He'd do anything for you.
I suppose.
Were you in love with him once?
What difference does that make?
I just ask. He could make trouble for us later.
You leave him to me, Chris. I know how to handle him. I know just how to handle Rene.
Moments later, you're back on the terrace, mingling with Van Loven's guests. You're being your most charming self, aren't you, Chris? The center of attraction as usual, and you're enjoying every minute of it. Van Loven is standing close by watching you, a quaint little smile on his face.
Oh, Mr. Holmes is a very, very clever young man,
oh, yes.
Is he not, my friend?
Oh, yes.
Well,
Mr. Van
Loven.
I dare say there isn't one of us here in this room he could not impersonate.
Oh, I
you, Major Ritten, for example.
Yeah? What's that? Me? Oh, my God, I say now, really. You think so, eh?
Well,
that's too hard.
But that would be perhaps too simple for our young friend. Perhaps we should have him try someone else.
Not anybody you say, I'll be glad to do.
Perhaps, Mr. Holmes, you would care to impersonate me.
No, he couldn't possibly. Oh, then he might go
and try. I make it a rule never to subject my host to that sort of punishment.
Oh, then I am most disappointed. I was certain you were planning a little surprise for me.
Surprise?
Mr. Van Loven?
Come on, old boy. Don't try to get out of this one.
My records, Mr. Holmes. I overheard you playing several of them. I thought you were studying my voice.
Well, I'm afraid I have a confession to make, Mr. Van Loven. I did try. I have to admit defeat. Afraid I couldn't quite come up to it. No. Really, I'd rather not. Huh? How about somebody else? Anybody
Holmes,
else?
You could try to impersonate my husband.
His voice is rather unusual.
Now, Stella, really, I don't think Mr. Holmes would be interested.
Oh, nonsense. Now, say something for the man, Edgar.
Well, say something, anything. Well, come on.
You oblige her, don't you, Chris? And your impersonation of the mild little man goes over well, much to his embarrassment. Then you're called on to do others to the delight of the assembled guests. But through it all, you're a little on edge. You haven't forgotten Van Loven's request that you try to impersonate him. And the rather strange expression on his face when he mentioned having overheard you playing his record. Finally, you manage to break away and look for Catherine. But she's not in the house. And so you wander outside into the garden for a quiet smoke. And then near the radio building, you hear voices. Catherine.
But I don't like it, Catherine. I don't like it one bit.
Renee, darling, I told you not to worry.
But what do we know about him? How can we trust him?
Please, let's not argue. I know what I'm doing. Believe me, Renee, I know what I'm doing. He's important to us now. Without him, we haven't a chance.
All right. All right, Catherine. We'll do it your way. But once this is over...
Yes, darling, yes. Once it's over, then we'll see. We'll see.
It disturbs you, Chris, what you've heard. But then you're quick to tell yourself there's nothing to worry about. It's Catherine's way of keeping Simoneau in line, isn't it? And he's important to the success of your plan. You walk back to the house thinking about it, and you're certain that's all there is to it. Catherine is handling Simoneau in her own way. And yet as you return to your room and prepare to turn in for the night, you promise yourself that you've got to move carefully, very carefully from now on. Just in case you find yourself in the middle of a double cross. The following morning at breakfast, you discover that your host has plans for his guests. Motorboating, lunch at the Hotel Royal, and then the races. Plans that keep you from seeing Catherine all that day. And then when you and the guests return to the house early that evening, you hurry upstairs to dress for dinner.
Chris?
Huh? Oh, Catherine.
Chris, there's been a slight change in plans.
Yeah?
The plane has already left Canton.
Oh?
Simoneau just told me. It's scheduled to arrive here shortly before 9.
9? But we'll be right in the middle of dinner.
Well, I'll tell Van Loven you're not feeling well, that you won't be down.
All right.
Now, here's the message. Study it. Be at the radio room in an hour. I'll meet you there.
A few minutes after 8, you slip out of your room, hurry down the back stairs. Close by, you can hear the laughter of the guests assembled in the main dining hall. You hurry across the garden, enter the radio building. Catherine and Simoneau are there, waiting for you. From that moment, events move rapidly. Contact is established with the plane. You find yourself speaking into the microphone.
VSL, this is Albert Van Loven. You will disregard previous instructions to land at Hong Kong Air Base. Proceed to emergency field on Pelang Road for landing. Repeat, please.
Disregard previous instructions to land Hong Kong Air Base. Proceed to emergency field on Pelang Road for landing. Got it, Mr. Van Loven.
Once the radio has been disabled, there's a dash to the deserted airstrip on Pelang Road. And only a moment after Catherine's braked the heavy car to a stop, you hear it in the distance.
There it is, the plane. I don't schedule.
All right, Renee. Come on. Wait for us here, Chris. Renee and I will meet the plane.
Okay, but about that pilot, I won't hold still for murder.
Don't worry. He won't be harmed. We'll just tie him up.
You watch them as they hurry toward the landing strip. Then the plane circles overhead and comes in for the landing and pulls up to a stop. You sit there, waiting, listening, straining to catch some sound, but all is quiet. And then you see two figures hurrying toward you. One of them is carrying a suitcase.
Well, how'd it go?
Perfectly, Chris.
Here, Simoneau, I'll take that suitcase.
Yeah.
Oh, nice and heavy.
Get in, Renee.
Well, now what?
Back to town. I've made arrangements for us to leave by boat. I'll drop you and Renee off at a small cafe near the waterfront. You'll wait there till you hear from me.
Okay, baby. You're calling the signals. Relax, Simoneau. Relax. I don't like this waiting.
Forget it. Enjoy the floor show. Ah, she's cute. Quite a dancer.
Yes. Real cute.
Where you going, Seminole?
To get another drink. Our waiter seems too busy watching the show.
As you sit there watching the girl perform in the center of the smoke-filled room, you're suddenly aware of someone staring at you. An old man standing a few feet away. A look of uncertainty on his face, indecision. And then swiftly he moves toward you, hands you a slip of paper, and darts away into the crowd. You unfold the paper and read.
We will leave on the midnight plane for Saigon, the two of us, darling. Been just the two of us from the beginning. Come at once. This diagram will show you just where to meet me. Castro.
You stare at the paper in your hand. The carefully drawn diagram of the meeting place. The rendezvous where Catherine will be waiting. A quiet side street. Suddenly it hits you, Chris. A question knifes through your mind. Did the old man make a mistake, Chris? Was the note intended for Simoneau? You're certain it was, aren't you? It's been Simoneau and Catherine all along. You should have suspected that after what you overheard in the garden last night. You slip the paper back into your pocket as Simoneau approaches.
Did I miss anything?
Huh? Oh, no. Not a thing, pal. Got a cigarette?
Here, help yourself.
Oh, is this all you got?
You don't like our local brands?
Sorry. I always like to feel my level best.
There's a tobacco shop down the street, on the other side. Don't get lost,
I'll try not to.
Shall I draw you a diagram?
Diagram? No, thanks. I already have one.
Waiting here in the shadows for Catherine. You feel a little foolish about the way you've been used, don't you, Chris? Only the money matters now. You'll be able to take it for yourself and leave them, Catherine and Simoneau. That's the way it is, isn't it? The way it's been from the beginning, you're certain of it. You were just a puppet who could help them. The man with the many voices. Especially the one that sounded exactly like Albert Van Loven. Well, it's all over now. Your foolish dream that there was anything more to it than a coldly calculated hijacking job. As you stand here in the darkness waiting for Catherine, it becomes annoying. The way her words come drifting back, mixing you up, challenging your judgment.
Two odds make an even match, don't they, Chris? The money, darling, we can get away with it and have it all to ourselves. I love you, Chris. Remember that. I love you.
Yeah. Sure, you love me.
You tighten, draw back into the shadows at the sound of a twig snapping. Then you see her, Catherine, approaching slowly toward you. Your eye catches something else, too. The glint of moonlight on the gun in her hand. Suddenly, your blood runs cold as you realize the real reason for that note. It was sent to lure someone out here to his death. But you've already decided the note was meant for Rene Simoneau. Or was it? Perhaps you're the one scheduled to be Catherine's victim.
Who is it? Who's there?
As Catherine's voice comes through the darkness, you know you've got to decide. You can answer with either voice, your own or Simoneau's, and your decision will mean life or death. Then, as suddenly as it came, the panic leaves you. Instantly, the whole thing seems clear. You're a fool to think otherwise. The note and the bullet in Catherine's gun are meant for you. But there's still a way out, isn't there, Chris? You'll speak to her as Rene Simoneau. She'll come to you. Disarming her will be easy and the money will be all yours. You wait for her to speak again.
Anthony. Who's there?
Don't be afraid, darling. It's me, Rene.
The Whistler, pontooned to yesterday from May 22, 1949, from the CBS Pacific Network, starring actors and actresses who appeared on the series so much they were known as the Whistler's children, like Gerald Moore, Kathy Lewis, and Paul Frees. You're listening to An Hour of Crime on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Livonier, and now Paul Frees serves as announcer for Suspense. From September 22, 1949 on CBS, pretty much in this program's heyday, it had been on CBS for 8 years and was part of their Thursday night lineup at 9 o'clock. Over 15.5 million people tuned in for this story, Experiment 6R.
Tonight, Autolite and its 96,000 dealers present Mr. John Lund in Experiment 6R, a suspense play produced and edited by William Spear.
Entirely fitting somehow that here in the Carlton Plaza Hotel, where he spent so much of his life, we should honor this hero of science and pay him our humble gratitude. Mr. Brandt is, as you know, at this moment in our special clinic, and it's from there that he will address us on the subject of Experiment 6R, a page in the progress of science with which his name will forever be associated. When I received his letter and heard the thrilling news that, unknown to any of us, a human volunteer had actually... Well, it was, of course, inevitable that I should call this distinguished gathering together. I won't speak any longer now because minutes are precious. We're ready. Will you speak to us now, Mr. Brandt? Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Morris Brandt.
Brandt speaking. I don't know exactly how you good people of science are going to take my little story, the history of my own part in Experiment 6R. When I finish my story, if I finish it, you will wonder perhaps why I wish to tell it at all. Well, something about the irony of this situation appeals to me. I'm going to enjoy every minute of it. You know, even the fact that somebody just now pressed a buzzer and I jumped to attention and started speaking is ironic. Because I guess that's how Experiment 6R began a couple of months ago. Yes, just like that. Brandt speaking.
Coffee, Mr. Brandt.
Very well, sir. It was precisely 3:15. And 3:15 was the time for Mr. Paul Koblenz's afternoon coffee. Naturally, it was beneath the dignity of the manager of the Carlton Plaza Hotel to have the coffee served by anyone less than me, the assistant manager. And so each day, the coffee tray with its silver urn, silver sugar and creamer, silver spoons, and graceful Limoges cups was left on my desk by a waiter, ready for the humiliating ceremony. I picked it up and went in.
Ah, Mr. Brandt. You'll join me, of course.
Well, thank you, Mr. Koblenz.
A little coffee is very relaxing.
It was relaxing for him. My duties only began with bringing in the coffee. I had to set the silver tray on his desk and then wait while Mr. Koblenz detached a small key from his desk chain. Then it was my job to take the key and open the small wall cabinet near the heavily draped window where Koblenz kept a supply of liquor. I would take out a bottle of expensive brandy and carry it over to the desk. Koblenz liked the dash of it in his coffee.
Ah, thank you, Mr. Beck.
It was this part of the silly ritual that I hated most. That locked cabinet was a symbol of Koblenz's suspicion and distrust. No one but me was ever permitted to enter his sacred office, and I didn't drink. But that made no difference. The liquor was expensive and might be stolen. By whom? By me.
Mr. Brandt, I've been looking over the monthly accounts. Your latest innovation seems to be doing quite well.
The stag room? Oh, that was a lucky guess.
I think not. Your reasoning, I believe, was that businessmen like a place to lunch by themselves in quiet and comfort. It seems, Mr. Brandt, that you have the rare talent of knowing what people want.
Well, I hope so.
Especially when giving people what they want can be so profitable and lead to give you what you want. Yes, indeed, Mr. Brandt. You have a very successful record during your 12 years here. Perhaps too successful.
Why? What do you mean?
Success has the habit of making a man crave something further. I think we shall have to have a talk someday soon, Mr. Brandt. But that will be all for today. You may replace the brandy.
He handed me the little key to the cabinet. He had finished with me for the day. Back in my office, I thought of what Mr. Koblenz had said. Too successful meant only one thing. He thought that I was ambitious to hold his job, my only possible advancement. Mr. Koblenz was quite correct. I would do anything to have that job. Anything. Now, after 12 years of it, I was determined to have that job. Not because it was a better job, but because it was his. I didn't sleep well that night in my cramped inside room, thinking of Mr. Koblenz in his penthouse suite. But finally it was morning, and the hotel came to life again, with all its problems. There were the usual two or three bad checks accepted by the night clerk, and all the other boring, commonplace irritants. The only drama of the day was brought in by the housekeeper.
May I speak to you a moment, Mr. Brandt?
Yes, Mrs. Oven?
It's about 1402, Mr. Brandt.
What seems to be the trouble?
The maids won't make up 1402.
Why?
The room... I know it sounds crazy, but that room is full of rats.
Live rats? Oh, nonsense. The maids are imagining things.
It's true. I saw them myself.
Very well, Mrs. Overman. I'll see about it.
Everyone's afraid to go in 1402, so I hope you can get them out of there. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Brandt.
Live rats. What next? Room clerk, please. Hello? Brandt speaking. Who's the occupant of 1402? Dr. Tomlinson? Is he in his room? Well, when he returns to the hotel, please let me know. I shall have to speak with him. Rats. Well, it was fairly typical of the kind of problem which is automatically relayed to the assistant manager, being hardly glamorous nor important enough for the manager to be bothered with. Some difficult and taxing assignment, like greeting Greer Garson, maybe, would be more fitting use for the time and talents of Paul Koblenz. As I thought about it, and him, I began to hear a sound in my head like a clock ticking. I recognized that it was almost 3:15. As busy as I was, I could sense, without looking at a clock, that it was nearly 3:15. It was time for the buzzer on my desk to sound out the call which symbolized all the tyranny, all the pompous authority, and the warped, sadistic soul of... Brandt speaking.
Coffee, Mr. Brandt.
Very well, sir. Again, the humiliating ritual. Performing the services of a waiter to satisfy Paul Koblenz of his authority. And today he began the talk with me that he had been promising for so long.
Mr. Brandt, you have been with us for 12 years, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Koblenz. 12 years and 2 months.
And you have always impressed me as an ambitious man, a competent man.
Well, thank you, sir.
But you must realize that you have come as far up the ladder as is possible, at least while I am alive.
Well, I don't think that...
And I am a very healthy man for my age, Mr. Brandt. Eventually, you may replace me.
But, Mr.
But
Koblenz...
it will be a long time to wait, I'm afraid. A very long time indeed.
Well, I'm really awfully busy, Mr. Koblenz.
I have observed certain signs of restlessness in you during the last year or so.
Restlessness?
You're not satisfied to be merely the assistant manager. You dream of occupying this desk someday. My desk.
Will that be all, Mr. Koblenz?
I will tell you when you may go. You would like to have my salary, which is very considerable, instead of your own, which is a good deal smaller. I must say that no one is so well qualified. If anything should happen to me, you would automatically be appointed manager of the hotel.
Mr. Koblenz, I'm sure
we'll
I never...
We will not discuss the matter further. I just wanted to you to know that I know, as they say, what the score is.
Have you finished your coffee, Mr. Koblenz?
I have finished my coffee, Mr. Brandt. Good afternoon.
It was exactly 3:30 as Koblenz handed me the little key to the cabinet, and I replaced the brandy. I took the coffee things back into my own office and closed the door. I knew exactly what Koblenz had meant. He had actually said, I know you would like to eliminate me in some way, and I warn you, I'm on the alert. Don't try anything funny if you know what's good for you. As if there were the slightest chance. As much as I hated him, there was nothing I could do. Mr. Brandt speaking.
You asked me to call when Dr. Tomlinson returned to the hotel, Mr. Brandt.
What? Oh, yes. Thank you.
Yes?
Oh, yes, sir. I am Mr. Brandt, doctor, the assistant manager of the hotel.
Oh?
May I step in for a moment?
Well, yes, come right in. What can I do for you?
Well, I suppose you noticed your room hasn't been straightened. And, of course, it's not difficult to see the reason why. You have them caged, I see.
Oh, yes, yes. You mean my rats. They're beautiful specimens, aren't they?
Beautiful. How did you get them into the hotel?
Oh, the cage fits into a leather carrying case. Rather clever, isn't it?
I see. Well, I'm sorry, Dr. Tomlinson, but I'm afraid those rats will have to go.
Yes, dear me, I was afraid of that. Could only be for another day, Mr. Brandt. I'll be returning to New York tomorrow. I can't leave them now. They're the subject of an experiment that may lead to the cure of an extremely deadly disease, which, for scientific purposes, we refer to as 6R.
Well, I'm sure, Doctor...
Let me show you something here. You see this yellow powder? Now, take a look at this label.
Paradimethyl... Doctor, I really don't have...
Paradimethyl amino asbenzamine. It's commonly called a butter yellow, Mr. Brandt. You see, when a rat gets a bit of this daily in his food, he develops 6R within 4 months, a spreading internal growth which insidiously destroys vital tissues. And by the time the results are evident, the rat is past all hope, and in a very short time, it's dead.
Yes, Doctor, it's very fascinating, I'm sure. But I'm afraid... Oh, will this powder induce 6R in a human being, too?
Oh, almost certainly, but naturally, we haven't been able to try it. No volunteers.
I don't suppose it requires very large doses, either.
To develop 6R? Oh, no, indeed. Just a very tiny bit daily, and then... Mr. Brandt, surely you understand the importance of this work and why I must have the rats with me constantly? But if you insist, I shall move to another hotel, of course.
No, Doctor. I represent the management, and I ask you to stay. And I'll see that your room is straightened.
Well, I must say that's wonderful of you, Mr. Brandt. Are you interested in science?
Not until now.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, by the way, please tell the maid not to go near the cages. Sometimes the rats might bite, and it might be that they could transmit 6R that way. We're not sure, you understand, but it's better not to take any chances.
Yes, I understand. Is that powder, I won't attempt to pronounce it, is it quite safe in here?
Oh, yes, yes, see? No one could find it here.
I see.
And besides, no one would know what it was. If some got lost, it looks just like yellow dust. It would only be thrown away. I have more for the experiments. Don't worry, Mr.
Brandt.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry if we've inconvenienced you, Doctor. Oh, have you had dinner?
Why, no, as a matter of fact.
Oh, would you join me? 7 o'clock in the grill room?
Well, I should be very pleased.
Good. We'll talk some more. You know, I should think that someone who, well, is desperately ill, let us say, would be honored to be your volunteer. I know in similar circumstances... I should be proud. Until 7, Doctor.
You wish to see me, Mr. Brandt?
Yes, Mrs. Overman. It is very important that Dr. Tomlinson finish his stay.
Yes, sir.
I will meet the chambermaid in his rooms promptly at 7:15 and see to it that the rats don't frighten them.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt.
The doctor arrived exactly at 7, And at 7:10, while he was still sipping his sherry, I excused myself and went up to 1402. When the chambermaid was taking the soiled linens to the laundry wagon in the hall, leaving me alone in Dr. Tomlinson's room, I filled a hotel envelope with a deadly yellow powder. I was back downstairs before the soup was served. I have never enjoyed a dinner more. Dr. Tomlinson prattled on, but I didn't even hear. I was thinking what a pleasure it was going to be to have coffee at 3:15 tomorrow afternoon with Mr. Paul Copeland.
Autolite is bringing you Mr. John Lund in Experiment 6R. Tonight's production in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Brandt speaking.
Coffee, Mr. Brandt.
Yes, Mr. Copeland. A waiter had just brought the tray, set it on my desk, and left. My door was locked. I took out the envelope with the powder, put a pinch of it into one of the costly Limoges cups, filled both cups with coffee from the silver pot, and carried the tray into the sumptuous office next door. The office that would soon become my own.
You will join me, of course, Mr. Brandt.
Of course, Mr. Copeland. Of course I would. I always had. But beginning with today, I would enjoy it. There was not the slightest alteration in the usual ridiculous routine. Copeland removed the little key from his chain and handed it to me. I got the brandy from the cabinet. Copeland poured a bit of the brandy into his cup and took a sip.
Exceptionally good coffee today, Brandt. They make it yourself?
What? Why, how do you mean?
Oh, don't take me so seriously, Brandt. But knowing your efficiency in all matters of the hotel, I'm sure you could prepare a very unusual cup of coffee.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, Mr. Copeland.
But I know you haven't time to waste in making coffee. Too busy thinking of ways you can work your way into my job, aren't you? And as I told you before, you won't get it while I live, and I come from a very long-lived family.
Yes, surely. More coffee, sir? Nothing could possibly go wrong. I had found out enough from Dr. Tomlinson to know that humans... and I stretched a point to include Paul Koblenz, that humans responded to drugs in very much the same way as rats. That was the reason rats were used for experiments in medical research. Almost invariably, the drugs that could kill a rat could kill a man. But the powder would never be detected, only its effect. When, after months of tiny doses, Koblenz would suddenly learn that he was harboring the hidden killer, 6R. I kept the powder in my jacket pocket. As the weeks passed, it became a matter of routine to put some in Paul Koblenz's daily coffee. But try as I would to remain calm, sometimes the excitement of it would become almost unbearable, particularly at the moments when I served the coffee.
Mr. Brandt, I can't tell you what pleasure this afternoon cup of coffee gives me. And, of course, it gives me one of the few chances I get during the day to see my busy and trusted assistant. That is a pleasure, too.
Thank you, Mr. Koblenz.
Oh, I received a letter a few days back from a Dr. Ernst Tomlinson.
Tomlinson?
He was a guest here, I believe, for several days.
Oh, really? Well, I don't...
Surely you haven't forgotten. He wished specifically to be remembered to you. The gentleman with the rats.
Rats? Oh, yes, I do recall something.
Yes, of course. I realize, Mr. Brandt, that I have allowed many of my managerial duties to fall on your capable shoulders, which action has perhaps given you a mistaken opinion of your authority on these premises. But really, Mr. Brandt, live rats in a room.
The animals were caged?
I think I should have been consulted. Fortunately, our other guests were not cognizant of the fact that we were for 2 days zookeepers of a sort. If they had known, I'm afraid, Mr. Fenwick... should have immediately replaced you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Koblenz.
Yes, I am sure. The good doctor seemed quite taken by you, Mr. Brandt. Have you a personality side you've never shown me? I've always considered you rather dull.
Will that be all, Mr. Koblenz?
You're angry. Well, no matter. See, yes, that would be all. I'm rather tired today. Go, please.
Dr. Tomlinson had written, but only to compliment me. That was good. He hadn't missed any of the yellow powder. As far as Koblenz's insulting behavior was concerned, well, there wouldn't be much more of it. Dr. Tomlinson had said there were no outward effects to 6R. But the tiny admission of fatigue on Paul Koblenz's part was, I felt, a good sign. I watched Paul Koblenz grow progressively more testy and insulting. 2 weeks into the fourth month of Experiment 6R, and in a way I didn't expect, the last scene began. Under the insurance laws of our state, all employees participating in group insurance had a yearly physical examination. The 4 months Dr. Tomlinson had considered necessary to allow the growth of 6R were almost completed. By now, 6R would have taken hold of Paul Koblenz, sufficiently to be recognized in a medical examination, and sufficiently to be at that point incurably fatal. Even at this late date, there were outwardly no signs of Koblenz's illness, which would make the announcement by the insurance doctor even more shocking. It was a nervous moment. Brandt speaking.
Mr. Brandt, I have set aside 2:30 as the time for my visit to the insurance doctors. That should get me back to my office for coffee, after which, if you have no pressing duties, you may...
Yes, Mr. Koblenz. At 3 o'clock, I heard him come back into his office next door. He walked rather heavily, I thought. I wanted desperately to see him at once, to see the reaction he must have to the news the insurance doctors had given him. But I waited. Finally, it was 3:15. Brandt speaking.
Coffee, Mr. Brandt.
Yes, Mr. Koblenz. The waiter had brought the coffee tray as usual. I carried it in. Koblenz sat quietly at his desk, his face partially in the shadow from the drawn blinds.
You'll join me, of course, Mr. Brandt.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Koblenz.
Here's the key.
I set the tray down, took the little key to the liquor cabinet which stood against the wall, and bent over to open it. There was a new mirror above the cabinet, and what I saw in it made me drop the bottle.
Anything wrong, Mr. Brandt? You seem startled.
The cops. The cops.
You've turned absolutely white as death. But then I meant to talk to you. You haven't been looking well for some time.
You changed.
I beg your pardon?
You switched the coffee cup while I turned away to get your brandy.
I always do. It is an old custom in my family. An old German custom. A very old custom. A very old and long-lived family.
Have you all this time?
Yes, Mr. Brandt. All this time. Operator, connect me with the insurance doctors, please. In 308. Is it possible for you to see Mr. Brandt immediately, doctor? Thank you. It's urgent.
So, Experiment 6R is finished. I am glad to have been of service to science, but I just couldn't die without sharing the credit with Mr. Koblenz. I'm sorry, truly sorry, that he could not be there with you today in his old capacity as manager of the hotel. But Mr. Fenwick saw fit to discharge Mr. Koblenz when it was brought to his attention that live rats had been permitted to spend the night in one of our rooms. And now, thank you for your attention and goodbye.
I was just bringing your order, Mr. Brandt.
Your friend just phoned and told me. If you'd only mentioned it before... You'd...
Friend?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Koblenz.
Koblenz? But I didn't order anything.
Oh, now, Mr. Brand, it's no trouble. We know now about your little custom. If you want coffee at 3:15 every day, you shall have it. Come now. It's just 3:15.
Suspense, presented by Autolite. Tonight's star, John Lund, in Experiment 6R.
Next Thursday for Suspense, Charles Lawton and June Havoc will be our stars. The play is called Blind Date, and it is, as we say,
a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Tonight's Suspense play was produced and edited by William Spear and directed by Norman MacDonald. Music for Suspense is composed by Lucian Morawek and conducted by Lud Gluskin. Experiment 6R was a radio play by Donald Stubbs and Harold Kalm. John Lund may currently be seen in the Hal Wallace production for Paramount, My Friend Irma. In the coming weeks, you will hear such stars as Van Johnson, Edward Arnold, and Betty Davis. Don't forget, next Thursday, same time, Autolite will present Suspense, starring Charles Lawton and June Havoc.
Suspense, on Tuned to Yesterday from September 22nd, 1949 on CBS. Bringing to a close this hour of crime on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.